are you really sure that this is a good idea? Because my first reflection was that I really hadn't trained my academic muscle for a couple of decades, and also not being able to explain what I'm doing, why I'm doing it, and how come it sometimes works. Then what good could I be to your institution and to all your students? Sometimes my family understands what I'm doing, but even that is not always the case. But I was received with a lot of tolerance and openness, and they said, don't worry, we like you and we take you as you are. So all this just to warn you against this lecture, because I'm not going to spoil you with beautiful academic points and slides. I will kind of just take you through some of the most important learning from my professional life, and it'll be very straightforward. We are, I believe, most of us, I can see not all of us, but most of us are from a part of the world where ascetic doctors and Puritan priests have led a 300-year-long anti-hedonistic crusade against the pleasure-giving qualities of food and against sensuality as such. For centuries, the idea of preparing wonderful meals for your loved ones was considered a sin in line with theft, exaggerated dancing, incest, and masturbation. The philosophy so successfully communicated by these fine people was that if you want to live a long and healthy life on earth and avoid going to hell, what you have to do is to eat something of inferior taste and get it over with in a hurry. It was in this spirit that I was brought up in a middle-class family in the 60s, the darkest period of Danish food history. My mother, Ulla Clausen, represented the first generation of Danish women working outside the home. Her luck was that this was an era of canned meatballs, potato powder, sauce, coloring, and of the stock soup. I was formally raised on a diet composed of chopped fatty meat of the cheapest possible quality and frozen vegetables pre-boiled years before in Kazakhstan, Romania, Poland, and other wonderful Eastern European places. Those vegetables, as well as the chopped meat, was stocked in massive chest freezers that we had in our basement. Most of the meat, that was pretty fat in itself, was wrapped in toasted breadcrumbs 3 to 4 times, and then deep fried in margarine packed with trans fatty acids. We used the excessive margarine as the most common dipping or sauce in my childhood. So no wonder that at the age of 15, I weighed 95.7 kilos, and I was one of the three fattest kids in southern Denmark. As you may recall, at this point, eating in my childhood was never a matter of reaching out for the beauty of life. It was a matter of efficiency. Food should be cheap. It should be prepared and eaten in less than 30 minutes. Normally we did it in 10 minutes and without talking together. And then we got on to the important things in life. What then radically changed my life was 1 year spent in Gascony, in southern France. I happened to work as an au pair with this man up there, fourth generation baker, Mr. Guy Sversut, and his wife Elizabeth. The case was that they could not have children, and they always wanted a son. And I remember I felt like a son there. I felt like his son when he taught me to kind of fill a deep bone guinea fowl with a beautiful fast made from the flesh from the thighs, with cubes of foie gras and grated truffle and armagnac. And I felt, extremely proud to be able to, at the age of 20, to participate in this beautiful little process. I think you can even see it on my smile. I'm a proud young Dane working with a fourth generation master. So they always had wanted a son. On my side, my parents had divorced when I was 14, and I didn't see my father very much anymore, and my mother became an alcoholic. So without knowing it, he and I, we were a pretty good match. Until this day of my life, Guy, who died in 2009, is the most generous person I have ever met. His bakery was a time pocket reflecting the golden age of French culinary craftsmanship. He was a man who always bought the best produce without ever challenging the price. He gave away a lot of stuff, and he offered most clients a discount. His recipes were extremely complex, and on top of all that, he had way too many employees. So one day, that was before I started at CBS, I actually decided to question his business model. Because I was looking at the tears, then at the face of his wife, who wanted to get out of Agen, the capital of Gascony, once in a while, maybe buy some new clothes, but there was kind of no money for that. And I took her part. So why did I challenge Guy? Why did I have the courage to do that? I think that the reason behind it was that my father's life philosophy was that happiness is about being more efficient tomorrow than yesterday. He found that I was a lazy boy when I was a teenager, and I probably was. But he tried to get that laziness out of my fat body. So what he did was to train my mind, and I found myself cutting the grass lane around our house 3 years in a row, three times a week. While my father watched me do it, he time-lapsed and he gave me penalty points if I left unfinished patches. So with this kind of respect for time, I told Guy that instead of drinking pastis and playing on horses, he should kind of lead his team and make us work a little bit more efficient. Yet, by the way, he had at least three patronships too much under his payroll. He didn't care about that. He just put his big pastry chef hands on my shoulders and looked at me with his, with a warmth by which he always looked at me. And then he shared with me a couple of ideas that I believe I will remember to the end of my life. The first thing he said was that he liked to quote French philosophers such as Baudelaire and Félicien Marceau. And what he said that day was that Félicien Marceau a dit, in French in verse, I think, le bonheur, c'est savoir ce que l'on veut et le vouloir passionnément. Et mon fils croit que tu fasses, il faut que tu l'aimes. In English, it goes somewhat like this: happiness, my son, is about knowing what you want to do with your life and having the guts to follow your heart. And I mean, comparing those words with my father's philosophy, I don't care shit about what you're doing as long as you fucking hurry up. There was some sort of discrepancy that I had to think about. In his next quotation, he more directly addressed this issue of haste and timing. And he said that le temps c'est le pire ennemi non pas seulement des métiers de bouche, mais aussi de l'amour et de l'homme tout bref. Haste is the worst enemy, not only for gastronomy, but also for not only for gastronomy, but also for love, and maybe for humanity or civilization as such. So those words gave me something to think about, as did the whole year spent in this culinary paradise after the first 19 years in my culinary darkness in southern Denmark. So when I went back to to Denmark, I needed to find something to rely on. And what happened in France was that I got a calling. I knew from the age of 20 that I didn't know that I was able to do it all the way down the road, but I felt strongly that I would spend my life trying to change the food culture of my country. I simply believed that if I could do so, then there would be enough love for everyone. And that is some sort of a CSR mission, I think. I eventually decided to study. I didn't have any better idea of how to proceed. I knew that I was pretty good at cooking, but I didn't know if that would take me all the way, and I always have loved to have a plan B. So therefore, I actually decided to study at this institution, as it was said. And this is actually a slide from my first year study. And so what was said before is totally correct. I find all ways of comparing, in this case, quality of life with the sense of time. In my own family, we got the microwave oven in 74, and my parents divorced in 77. Kind of research prize for the study, but I think that it is, in all its banalities, kind of interesting. Starting with this canteen that I happened to get the chance to run. Also, I have to say that I, without having the permission from this institution, I grew my chocolate company out of the room where we kept the cleaning stuff. It was a strange story. So that was the first company, and then I grew a number of others, typically very small culinary companies. Without, I never learned how to make budgets. And I always felt that business plans, if not boring, then it took so long time. And the beautiful thing about being an entrepreneur and not having to ask other people for money is you don't need to make business plans budgets. So I always make very, very small companies, often within other companies. I kind of got access to other people's production equipment, and therefore I never had to show anyone a business plan. I guess, this thing feels right. I don't have to invest anything. Why don't we just move on and try to see what comes out of it? So what actually characterized, and I'm sure that somebody from this room will be able to more, compile my different projects in different categories, but with my limited understanding of what the hell I'm doing, what I can say is that I never planned to run a big company. I was always looking for, as I said, startups or opportunities with low entry barriers, obviously because I had no money in my pocket for many, many years. And also with low exit barriers, because I didn't see myself as a classical businessman who would spend his entire life growing some company. I saw myself as a change maker. So I liked the idea of being able to jump from one company to another if I felt that I would make a bigger difference, a bigger impact, with reference to this idea of improving the food culture somewhere else. So low entry and low exit barriers. I always, obviously, because I wanted to change stuff, I wanted to make a pretty, if not spectacular, then kind of strange projects or startups that would challenge the classical, ancient competitive parameters in that industry. And often there would be no demand for that in the very beginning. So I usually started companies producing products or services that nobody needed. So one other thing that I had to learn the hard way down the road was how to change the market without having money to do it with. So I will give you a couple of very pragmatic examples of how I kind of succeeded in changing demand as we moved on, starting some tiny unprominent operation in some corner of an old industry. And then finally, and I think you have guessed that, I have for my entire life been prepared to sacrifice the opportunity to reach out for short-term profits if I can preserve the chance to do something really great. So where did it take me? It took me to a point where these days we are about 800 employees, and we have a yearly turnover of 75 million euros, and we actually started in 2009 even to earn money, and I think that otherwise I wouldn't have been here today. I won't go too deep into the idea of change of a kind of because I mean that goes by itself that a main strategic challenge was to find a way of making monopolistic structures collapsing. So I mean that was the Minister of Food. I received myself my main role as one of promoting diversity, because when you have diversity you have engagement. You have a language for speaking about the differences in text. If you have, when there's lack of diversity, when there's monopolistic structures, it leads to ignorance and shitty production schemes that are bad for the landscapes and for the animals. So I knew from my learning from France that when you have 15,000 winemakers, 25,000 cheesemakers, that kind of in itself, without any governmental initiative, produces a certain culture around the consumption and also an internal competition in the industry that drives quality upwards. So that was, I saw myself as some sort of a catalyst. I didn't necessarily want to earn companies, so actually when I helped Carlsberg redefining their role in the brewing industry, and when I had the chance to inspire Arda to get into making raw milk cheese once again after a 70 years lack of raw milk cheese culture in Denmark, then I did what I had to do in different industries. And why did I choose to spend my time there? Because I felt that I made a much bigger difference changing Arla or changing Carlsberg than while selling you know, food for 30 people at a marriage. So, let's move on to this is actually how myself I see those companies or those initiatives in that sort of, in this case, is a brown ocean. Brown ocean initiatives. One of the cases that I think could be most interesting for you to hear a little bit about is the Noma and Nordic cuisine movement thing. I mean, until 2002, I didn't feel that I had a very important impact on the Danish food culture, even though I had been offered the chance to make no less than 290 TV shows. I didn't really feel that it kind of resulted in a shift of paradigm. But at the beginning of this millennium, gastronomy in the leading culinary countries, Spain, France, and Italy had become increasingly elitist, irrelevant, and detached from most people's thinking about food and sustainability and pollution and global resource issues and obesity and things like that. So somehow I felt that maybe there was a window of opportunity to redefine the order in the world of gastronomy. So René Rezegui and I, we started this little restaurant in Christianshavn, Noma, and I remember that we had high ambitions. We wrote in the very first menu that with this restaurant we want to create a new Nordic cuisine that embraces the Arctic and brightens the world by virtue of its great taste and unique character. Pretty pretentious, you may think. And I totally agree. But the whole point was that, and is the food matters beyond pure pleasure. And that I think is also what my lecture is about today. Food matters beyond pleasure. 90% being lost in less than a century. It is beyond doubt that we are in the middle of a process of mass extinction of the biological species on Earth. The interesting thing is that this time it is life destroying itself, so to speak, in the sense that in a period of just about 150 years, it seems as if one very intelligent species is almost single-handedly demolishing its own livelihood as well as large parts of the biosphere. 1 billion people are suffering from hunger and poverty, and another 1 billion people are suffering from obesity at the same time, and we feel kind of powerless towards all that. But Leonard Cohen once wrote, "There is a crack in everything, and that is where the light gets in." Man holds a unique position amongst the living creatures on Earth, and evolution has provided us with the ability to think and to show compassion. So the beautiful thing about it is that that we can still do something about it. In 2002, before starting this restaurant, Renee and I found that a time had come for chefs to raise their voice and stand up and try to become responsible role persons, taking a responsibility for the evolution of society. We wanted to redefine luxury so that it would no longer just be about the foie gras and champagne and lobster and Coke. We wanted to emphasize seasonality through cooking. We wanted to restore the missing link between food and nature. And we wanted the meal to reflect time and space. Where are we now? What time of the year are we having this meal? We wanted great food to be compatible with healthiness and sustainability. And we thought that this could be a pretty interesting position to take for food culture, because French and Spanish food was about deliciousness and maybe a little bit about ancient food. But no food culture in the world had won the position to be the best at delivering, at performing at the edge where deliciousness and sustainability and healthiness meets. The reality for Noma, however, was that we were on a suicide mission. Our colleagues doubted that we would survive more than a winter, relying as we did only on local produce. Nothing is growing in this part of the world in December, and how the hell could we have do it? And I have to say that the first winter was not very funny for chefs and Nomas. And most people, I mean the chefs, I mean, not in a cruel way, but they made fun of us. They spread the rumor that this Arctic place was serving seal penis, rotten intestines of Arctic birds, baby whales, and other horrors or kind of disasters from the National Nordic Culinary Chambers of Horror. So in the early days of Noma, now it's funny to say because these days the restaurant is full, but in the early days a dinner invitation for our restaurant sounded more like a threat. So what to do about that, and what to do about our mission? We wanted to create a new Nordic cuisine, but as there were no guests, we were only one dishwasher, two waiters, and three chefs. And even though we were courageous, I didn't see how we could kind of make a critical difference as to this idea. So then we got this beautiful idea that refers to the idea of changing demand, now that you are in the business. So what we did was that we invited the gastro intelligentsia to a Nordic cuisine symposium, the basic idea of which was to unite chefs and farmers in all Nordic countries, small and big companies, politicians, retailers, food producers, and even private people around a common vision. So we asked all those participants at the Nordic Cuisine Symposium that was held in 2004, at a moment when Noma was about to go bankrupt in 3 months. We asked them the question, are we allowed in this part of the world to dream of one day handing over to our children a food culture that is so much more delicious, admirable, and so much more wonderful and respectable than the one we inherited from our parents. And everybody seemed to feel that that was okay. That wasn't too much to dream about. Then we asked, beforehand we had asked ourselves the question, if one should embark on such a project, what should be the values that would have some sort of timelessness to them? What should be the values that one should execute upon or materialize through a cultural change process if one wanted to this idea to result in a food culture that would be kind of extremely delicious, extremely respected and admired by people from the whole world. So we presented the Nordic cuisine ideology through this manifesto at the symposium, and people seemed to like what we had made. So we also asked them, so through this symposium we actually asked a number of key people to explore through their lectures what would be the potential benefits for the Nordic region if together we could reach out for this vision and make it come true. What would it mean to health costs? What could it potentially mean for tourism? What could be the impact on food exports? What about pride? What about happiness? Does that make any sense? And the last question we were asked everyone was if they were prepared to do their part. And then, you know, 24 hours later, everybody went home and nobody knew what would happen. But the beautiful thing was that everybody actually did home and did their part. I remember that one year after the symposium, the Nordic Council of Ministers adopted the ideology and turned it into a new Nordic program that would distribute a certain number of kroner to different kind of projects that would be applied for by entrepreneurs in the Nordic countries. And today, 9 years later, cabbage is the new black. Rye is worshipped. Wild herbs are being collected and sold in supermarkets, at least in Copenhagen. Festivals celebrating our emerging beautiful food culture, or even the local Nordic region's food cultures are emerging all over the region. Nutritionists and chefs, and Per will know about that, nutritionists and chefs are turning those avant-garde gastronomic ideas into everyday life eating pattern named the New Nordic Diet. And thousands of young, vibrant food companies have been born during the last 3 to 4 years, and a handful of Nordic restaurants have suddenly entered out of nowhere. Not only Noma, but a handful of restaurants have entered the list of the world's 100 best restaurants. And similar structures as the ones we have created are emerging by themselves in Russia and Turkey and the Caribbean Islands and the Netherlands. So the question is, why did it all happen? And I know that people from this institution that think the department or whatever it's called of creative industries have been doing some new research with Howard about it. But I don't remember actually the output of that, but from my side, I think that one important, very important thing was that from the very beginning, we thought as the new Nordic cuisine as a benign virus, a movement that was co-created and co-owned by all the stakeholders. And if they were not prepared to do their part, it would all just collapse before it amounted to anything. So we thought of it as a virus with values such as openness, total inclusion and democracy. Anyone could always step into the New Nordic Cuisine movement and do whatever that person wanted to do and benefit according to the quality of the contribution regulated by the marketplace. Never ever, there was this set of values and some sort of a guiding light to everyone, but never ever were there any answer book or a logo or a president or a vice president or a committee to ask for this or that. So no presidency, no rules, no logo, only an appealing set of values that happened to be compatible with the global zeitgeist and apparently with the capacity to change the game of gastronomy. All that being said, and contrary, I think, to what most people think when they read about Noma, this was never ever about creating a great restaurant. For me, Noma has always been an instrument. And the New Nordic cuisine is not and has never been a search for clinical culinary excellence or excellence in hospitality. We simply wanted to use deliciousness as a weapon towards some of the greatest challenges of our time. 3 years down the road, Manures Everywhere is doing a marvelous job, and I felt that there was a risk that I was kind of overshadowing his work, and why should I run around doing something that he was so good at doing? So I asked myself if I should try this idea of that I had found pretty successful in this case, to create a movement, some sort of a movement like structure. What industry would be a good fit for that? And I ended up taking a deep glance at the grain flour bread value chain. And why that? Because 95% of all bread consumed in the Nordic region is made from white refined flour, and even though we tend to forget it, the reality is that that consumption pattern leads to diabetes and obesity. So that kind of bread is bad. Bread is bad. I didn't like it either. I think bread deserves a better destiny or a better reputation. That was one thing that contributed to this sense of a burning platform. The second thing was that in Denmark, whether it's a private person or a professional baker who does the bread, when we started our project, flour would come from Kazakhstan. It would be milled in Finland and sold as Englemark in Coop. And I mean, that was not compatible with the New Nordic cuisine idea of expressing the landscapes and through your food and having a terroir dimension like they have in Burgundy when they make wine. So I didn't like the idea, for me it was also a sign of a potential that the story was untold. So all Danish, sort of Danish flour being grown in Kazakhstan, milled in Finland, and transported all those thousands of kilometers, that untold story was a gem in our attempt to create some sort of enthusiasm about the idea of changing the shit. And thirdly, 90% of all grain being used for bread was unorganic when we started. 95% of all grain was unorganic. Everyone knows that it costs so little more to produce a bread made from organic flour because most of the cost that goes into it is water and manpower. And for every kilo of grain that is grown organically, 330 liters of groundwater is being freed from pesticides. And finally, there was so much deliciousness being lost because everybody thought that bread should be made with a lot of yeast in a very short span of time. And even from an economical point of view, this makes no sense at all. So it's a matter of planning production a different way. So therefore, before actually entering bread, and we eventually entered this industry, instead of making a big bakery or a big flour venture, we decided to make a total attack on the whole value chain. So simultaneously, you ended up creating a small bakery, a small flour project with a great organic flour, one of the organic movement pioneers, Per Brobe, baking classes, and the bread book. And through the whole value chain, from those very, very tiny, fragile positions, we expressed that value. But before, and now the video guys have to be coming ready, but before doing anything, the funny thing is about you have a certain authority, you have a certain legitimacy when you speak out before you are a salesman. So I decided to try to share this idea of changing bread together, changing bread, before I had anything to sell. And I said, why should I share this idea? Why would I have a chance to spread it at a low cost? And we decided to go a long way and create a food stall at the Roskilde Music festival in order to have an occasion to create a bakery that would give us a reason to speak out about bread. And for some reason, there was some video shooting going on, and therefore I can share with you what happened when I invited people to dig into this idea of changing bread together. And I think you will feel what I felt when I stood there.
Vi er på Roskilde i år med Majas Bageri og Deli, som en protest imod de internationale fast- og junkfood-konglomerater. Og jeg vil gerne fortælle jer meget kort en historie om, hvordan jeres brød bliver bedre end noget, I nogensinde har bagt. Regel nummer 1. Hvidt brød er noget lort. I er nødt til at have noget kim og klid, en lille smule fuldkornsmel med nede i melet. Regel nummer 2. Der skal mere vand i dejen. Der skal mere vand i dejen. Problemet er, at alle brødopskrifter... mere vand i dejen! Regel nummer 3. Gæld som ind i helvede. Vi skal ende 10-15 minutter. Regel nummer 3. Det er mere salt. Vi skal have 25 gram salt per kilometer, fordi salten fremmer brødsmager korn, og det næste der er lang hævetid. Normalt så hæver man 50 gram gær, står der, og så hæver man 2 timer, og man går på toilettet, og så bærer man brødet. Det er løgn! Det her er en lille... Man kan ikke få et godt brød frem på 2 timer. Man skal fænde med lortet, og man skal give det de 8 timer, det skal have, eller 16, eller 24. Så regel nummer 5 er, at man går ned i gærmængde. Kan I se det? Gå ned i gærmængde! 1, 2, 3! Sådan! Helt opmærkt! 1, 2, 3! For når man kommer ned i gærmængde, så kommer man op i havetid. Og den lange havetid, det gør, at brødet på naturlig måde danner mælkesyrebakterier. Og det fantastiske med mælkesyrebakterier er, at de gør kornets næringsstoffer tilgængelige for kroppen. Er det en god idé, at kornets næringsstoffer bliver tilgængelige for kroppen? Ja! Yeah! Den sidste regel, det er faktisk bare, at man skal bage sit brød i en varm ovn. Mange ofte skriver 180 grader, 190 grader, 180 grader. Ovnen skal være varm! I Merko kan man købe en stenplade til 198 kroner. Den kan man bryde ind igennem ind i en hvilken som helst ovn. Og så kan man varme stenpladen op, og når den er varm, så kan man bage stenovn! Så det var sådan set bare det, inden I kom. Tak fordi jeg støttede os hernede. Og så er der gratis brød til alle sammen.
Salespeople, and we didn't believe in the idea of selling stuff to people, imposing on other people your stuff, and we didn't even do kind of classical marketing stuff. So we had the idea that whenever we start a company, if we could not just by sharing the story behind it, or the idea of getting there in the market with those products, if that in itself would not fire up the market and create a demand that would be sufficient to sustain the business, then the idea was not good enough. Okay, it is easy to get trapped by your own luck, but as I said, Noma was never meant to be an end, nor was the Nordic cuisine movement intended to be just about branding a certain region. We all know that the Vikings burned down the European villages and raped their women. I like to believe that the Nordic cuisine movement is different. That it is not a crusade against Mexican mole or French bœuf bourguignon. It is not a declaration of war, not even against pizza or burger. So if our movement should be a threat against anything, then let it be the junk and fast food industry, dominated by massive, heartless corporations that ruin our health, undermine our independence, and potentially damage the planet. The best part, though, of this story I think, is the fact that if this culinary fairy tale could happen in Denmark, bearing in mind the nasty state of our food culture just 12, 13 years ago, then potentially it could happen anywhere. One day my very good friend and mentor, Jan Krag Jacobsen, former vice president, former president of the Gastronomic Academy, called me up and said that he had re-read the manifesto that we had sort of orchestrated together some years before, and he had come to the conclusion that you could actually leave out the word Nordic from it. And that maybe it was not about our food culture, maybe it was about defending authentic indigenous food cultures anywhere in the world. So I will get back to that in a moment. But just touching upon the company stuff, as you can see, I was at the point of collapsing in 2007. This is EBITDA. So before taxes, we were actually losing money at that point. And I had 400 employees, and I was unable to direct them and control them, and I was not very good at cost-cutting initiatives. So this was a point where, even though I'm a company owner, and therefore does not need to pay respect to everything that the board tells me, this was a moment where I actually listened. So I hired, on their recommendation, a CEO and another director with kind of complementary competences to mine. And as you can see, I didn't do much myself to contribute to the earnings of the company, but suddenly we started earning money. And in the end, I felt a little bit of bad conscience about it. I always liked the idea, and I don't want to bore you with the reasons why, but I always liked the idea of giving back more than I would take from the table, and have this sort of a license to hang around in the industry and do what I was doing, if everything was very transparent. And I thought that, I mean, if it goes on in this way, how in hell can I spend that money in a proper way? And what am I to do about it? So why not do something fun and great when we can do it? And therefore I founded the Melting Pot Foundation, and I said to myself and to my close colleagues that at least we can give in between 4% and 10% of the profit per year to people who need that money more than we seem to do. So therefore I started the Melting Pot Foundation, which is a charitable fund that intends to help people, marginalized or vulnerable people, through projects that have entrepreneurship, food or food crafts, as recurrent elements. And that was what brought me into a... Before I actually launched the video, I have to say that I was at a dinner with the director of the closed state prison, Vridsløse Lille, and I have to talk with him, Topper Andersen, the manager of that prison, and I just started this foundation, and I wanted to do something about people who were in shit, and in some way you say the people who are in prison, they are in trouble. There is a reason why they are there, but anyway, they have to kind of improve and get a better life. And then I asked him if he thought that you could do something with cooking, and then he said that, well, education in prisons, even though I'm part of it, it sucks. It doesn't work, so being in a prison is some sort of a criminality, a school of criminality. You get a better robber or drug dealer, but you don't necessarily get a better person with it. You don't improve your chance of succeeding in life if you've been in prison for 10 years. And then I got the idea that maybe you could start a food school in there. And I told him that if you will give me some of your toughest guys, I promise that in eight weeks, I am able to teach them to cook up a one-star Michelin meal. But you have to open up the prison so I can bring in real people. And then I want to tell these people that if they do what I tell them to do, they want to shine. They will flourish for one single day. And I think this could fire them up. And this is just a 2 minute video from the very first meeting. And why can we show this video? We can show it because we actually made a strategic alliance with Denmark's Radio, DR, because we felt, especially Kim felt, that somebody needed to launch a debate about resocialization in this country. My unlock in this case was that independently from this project of the Melting Pot Foundation and this strategic alliance with Denmark Partner North and Northeast Debate, I happened to employ a baker apprentice. And one is not supposed as an employer to ask what kind of crime did you commit then? Because if you have taken your sentence and have gotten out of prison, then it is because you have no memoirizing. With society, you don't know society anything anymore, and that every single citizen is supposed to punish the ex inmate once again. But then a certain coincidence happened, and 1 week before the program would start in television, this baker who had happened to throw his girlfriend out of a window from 8 meters, she wrote a chronicle about this thing in one of the major Danish newspapers. And at that point, I learned that even though I'm sure that most people in this room share the idea that every single person deserves, in principle, a second chance, and even though every single person, most persons, are born good, this idea was not reflected in how the people in Denmark perceive of the idea of resocialization. So the feeling in the beginning was that even though we don't kill people or put them into jail for their entire lives, we don't need to inspire them to become better human beings once they get out. That was how I felt. But that also gave me a chance to stand up for something. And I learned a lot from that process, and I'm very happy that I took all this battle out there. So why did we succeed? And I can tell you that we did succeed. We have now been running 3 food schools under the radar in 3 different prisons for more than 2 years. And the Department of, what is that called? The Department of, the Institute of Legal Affairs in the Southern Danish University will in January reveal a report that recommits, it's the final conclusion, as quick as possible, start food schools in all Danish prisons. What we did was very simple. We met those guys with the idea that they could one day become worthy human beings. They could get skills. We met them with care. We never let them down. We always promised what we told them. And we actually had them grow plants, nurse the sourdough, and cook the best possible foods from morning to night for those 8 weeks. And apparently that made a difference. So much about the prison. Then the other project in Melting Pot was the idea to see if it was possible to take the DNA of the Nordic cuisine movement, including this concept of starting a fine dining restaurant to showcase the principles. We wanted to see if we could do that in a poor country as a charity, if we actually give this knowledge away as a present and make it grow like a virus in a very different context. And we ended up in Bolivia. And why Bolivia? Because Bolivia is the poorest country in South America. One out of four people are suffering from hunger. One out of three people are unemployed. At the same time, it is the country with the largest biological diversity worldwide, and it is a country with a lack of self-confidence. It has lost all wars and a lot of football matches in 150 years. So and food stocks. So we felt that this was maybe, and also there's a low rate of criminality and a lot of poverty. And I like the concept of being able to come back to my family and friends, and I like that the people that I would send there would also have a good chance of coming back. So for all these reasons, I threw $600,000 on the table. I said, I need somebody to leverage that. And then Ibis, the Danish NGO, stepped in a little bit later. We got IFU, Danish governmental fund, on board, and then also the embassy chipped in with a little bit of investment. And with that money, we have created a local NGO, Melting Pot Bolivia, that has launched with IFU a fine dining restaurant called Gusto in the poorest capital of Latin America. And this is also a food school. So if you go there, the food is being cooked and served by these 30 people down there that are being turned into culinary entrepreneurs. Also, we have started a Bolivian food movement and a Bolivian food festival called Tambo that last year had 40,000 visitors in a wonderful big square in the city of La Paz. Knowing that Che Guevara was kicked out of that country when he wanted to help them after 1 week, I knew that there was a certain risk that I would lose both waste my time and my money. But so far, we are still working down there. And Gusto, a couple of months ago, was voted 32nd best restaurant in Latin America. And for the first time ever, a social project entered that kind of list. And also, the Dutch lottery through their NGO, ECO, a Dutch NGO, was so, they had too much money, they couldn't spend it in a wise way. They said, you execute great projects, we have a lot of money. Can you spend some of them for us? So with the money now from the Dutch lottery, $2.5 million, we are creating 14 micro restaurants, 14 cafeterias directly into the slums of La Paz, where people can come and eat for $1, great food made from local produce, and at the same time, those who cook the food will get an education. So in the next 2 years, we will teach and give diplomas that are endorsed by the state to 3,500 boys and girls from the slums of La Paz. We are close to the end. If I ever met God, it was in a bakery in Gascony when I was 20. My heart was open. I didn't know what to do with my life. And the bread was very good. He always told me that the more you give away, the more you will get back. I am not sure that life is that simple. I didn't have the courage to follow that philosophy in my early days. But he taught me and he inspired me to follow my heart, and he taught me that meaning always comes before profit. He got me onto the path of reaching out for win-win-win-win scenarios, as I think Christian Stated is calling it. This may not always be the commercially most rewarding business philosophy in the world, but as a means of unfolding the potential of your colleagues and your employees, and as a means of unlocking the power of a food culture to the benefit and joy for most people, I think it is an underrated business philosophy. In my board, when I launched this philanthropic arm, Melting Pot, I was often told by these clever people, just be clear that the money you give away is money lost forever. I answered that I was totally prepared to live with that, but that I was not sure that life was as simple as that. And the funny thing to this story is that 2 years ago I was called up by an American billionaire who has read about Bolivia and read about what I've been doing up here. And he eventually made sure that I understood that he would be willing to finance a 1,400 square meter food hall and restaurant in Grand Central Station in New York. And to the big surprise of my board, this is going to happen. This is now a reality. So with all his money, we are actually building a food place, a very important food place in the heart of New York, in the third most important landmark. And also, during our discussions, we came to the idea that maybe I shouldn't have royalty for the first couple of years because it was a startup and also was co-owner, the whole thing. And then I launched the concept that maybe he shouldn't have interest rates on his loan. And he thought initially that was a very strange idea. In fact, the idea of no royalty, but no interest rates, it was very strange in the world of finance. But then he asked for one day to think about it. And then he came back to me the next day with a Salomonic solution, in the sense that he said that I have to tell him, I mean, my father handed over part of all that money that I've got, so I have to be able to tell him that I kind of have calculated the interest rates. But I don't mind the concept of giving that money back to you so that you or we can use it together to do something great here. And that is why we are now in the process of doing something in a place where nobody has ever thought it was possible to do anything. In the sense that we are trying to build a soup kitchen and a food school and a bakery and a movement where we will team up with local citizens of Brownsville to remix, not revitalize or rejuvenate, but to remix, as Afro-Americans say, to remix soul food out there. So what is Brownsville? Brownsville is a community, 100,000 people, half of which are getting their money from the public authorities, they're in public housing. The highest rates of incarceration, criminality, unemployment, obesity, and diabetes anywhere in America. My first employee in the U.S. project was a young man, Lucas Denton, has been meeting with the people of Brownsville for 2 months and planned for my first meeting last week with different initiative leaders, citizens, and NGOs. This would be an opportunity to shake hands, share dreams, and most importantly, as in the prisons, to slowly win the confidence of the people we wanted to help. 3 days before the Brownsville community meeting, I met with the principal of CIA, the most affluent and the most powerful culinary institution in the United States. I said, I need your endorsement and for those diplomas that we're going to give to these black people, and very few black people get access to institutions, so can we agree that this is a good idea? And I also need your support. And they said, we are 100% in. 2 days before the meeting, I was suddenly contacted by a John Forte, a former member of the Fugees. Remember Fugees? An ex-prisoner, by the way, ex-drug dealer, and not-for-profit jewelry producer, marketing company owner, and a Brooklyn celebrity, and a potential role model for many of the kids in Brownsville, where he happened to be born. We didn't know each other. He said that he just reached out to support us and said he could come to that meeting that he had heard of. And the next day, that is the day before the meeting, I met with an old friend, Garrett Oliver, from Brooklyn Brewery. And Garrett Oliver is the world's most famous Afro-American brewmaster, the Arthur Ashe of hops. And the idea was that we should explore the potential commercial relations between Brooklyn Brewery and the Grand Central Project. Sometimes the conversation doesn't really take off. It was also the case here. He seemed busy and a little bit absent. And I found myself wondering, why am I actually to buy beer from this brewery or from another brewery? getting increasingly bored, I seen something and told him about browser. And for the first time in more than an hour, he stopped speaking and listened. So when after 8 minutes, I had no more to tell him about browser, he replied, "Klaus, for 15 years I've been touring the world with Brooklyn Brewery. I've met a lot of great people. We've been doing a lot of great stuff in different communities. So as a company, we give back in many ways. But for me personally, you make me feel like having a purpose, something extraordinary that I can stand up for. And your Brownfield project could maybe give me that meaning in my life. So could I be part of it?" And then within 5 minutes of jamming, we had added a house brewery to the Brownfield project. Garrett would teach the students to brew for free. He would receive some of them as interns and potentially offer them a job. And we would take the best recipes developed in Brownfield, brew them in the Brooklyn Brewery, have a street artist create a funky label, brew and bottle the beer, and sell it in Manhattan with the profits going back to the Brownfield project. And then, in addition to all that, suddenly Garrett and I had also found an emotional reason to do business together. When embarking on those crazy projects out in the philanthropic corner of one's life, I always get the feeling that we can fucking make it, even though it, from a rational point of view, seems totally impossible. But I never figured out why is it this way? Why is it actually more realistic than not that you kind of make it? And then yesterday morning I was running, and sometimes I happened to hit this random button on my iPhone. Instead of playing beautiful rock music when I toured down the Clive Bear Hill, then it suddenly had Peter Bastian reading from his book, Apprenticeship. And I'm sure, Christian, but would you say initially you would like this one? So what Peter Bastian happened to tell me in my ear yesterday morning when I was running around in the Frederiksberg Garden was this: in math, as well as in music and in life, when against all odds, you try to achieve something absolutely extraordinary, something distinctively good and true, then down the road, the simple beauty of the idea will fertilize the process. That's good. Will fertilize the process and deliver solutions you would never ever rationally have been capable of figuring out. I was a little bit afraid that these words would sound banal to all you intellectual masterminds, but for me they were a revelation. And I think that when in your lives, when you are doing your greatest projects and have to find the courage to kind of stand up for them, and you meet all these spreadsheet masturbators, impressive board members and anemic anorexic accountants, then remember those words. Don't always trust the spreadsheets. So now, to be realistic, this little melting pot foundation with one employee is probably not going to be amongst the 200 most important NGOs in the United States ever. But that is not important. So now comes the point, the final point. And this is the legend of the hummingbird that will tell you that point. So the legend has it that one day there was a tremendous forest fire. The terrified and shocked animals all watched the disaster, unable to help in any way. Only the little hummingbird bustled about back and forth, fetching a few drops of water at a time in its small beak to throw them on the fire. After a while, the armadillo, who was irritated by this pathetic display, said, "Hummingbird, are you crazy? Do you think that you are going to put out the fire with these ridiculous drops of water?" The hummingbird answered, "I know I can't, but I'm doing my part. Thank you."
Thank you very much. So now IOA and ICM would like to invite you all to join us upstairs, overlooking this Friedrichsberg garden where this man developed.